jury's like, oh, snap, a twist. Like, they love twists. Any great trial has a twist.
I suggest that we give him 10 years in Leavenworth or 11 years in Smallworth.
I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll take 5 and 10 in Woolworth.
Like this, Mr. Court.
Address the judge as your honor.
Well, it was like this, my honor.
Your honor, not my honor.
Why? Don't you like him?
You're meant to come down here and defend me against these characters, and the only one I've got on my side is the blood-sucking lawyer.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 310. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. Out over there is Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
I am doing great. We got so much to talk about. Big news week. There is so much to cover. We are surely not going to be able to accomplish it. But some announcements first, probably mostly related to what we can't do or don't have time to do. So I have a note here that we're doing opioids on Tuesday. So I guess the news cycle has gotten that depressing that we're just out with it. We're just
All right. You and I are going to sit in a room and take as much oxy and as we're going to discuss the landmark opioid trial.
Can't hear you. I'm doing opioids. What we're discussing? Oh shoot! Dang it.
Yeah, that's it's really, really important. People are going to wonder why we didn't cover it this week. We didn't cover it this week because of the crucial stories we are covering. We don't even get to in the next 2 episodes, right? Counting this one, we can't even cover an amazing ruling about Michael Cohen, the Trump Organization, and legal fees. I had to bump that off the whiteboard, and I had some really, really good Cohen jokes. I mean, it was going to be awesome. So this week exploded. So opioids are coming. Opioids, we'll be doing opioids on Tuesday.
It's about time. And also, little note. Yes, we were a bit late with Lot Awful Movies this month. People noticed, and we apologize. It was the live show. It was all that stuff. But we're going to make it up to you. We're going to do the Lot Awful Movies. They'll be coming to you within a few days here. Also, we are going to publish a free Lot Awful Movies. By popular demand, the Alex Jones deposition was an incredible episode of Lot Awful Movies. Very educational. It was funny, it was fun, and I learned a ton. We are going to publish that on the main feed for everybody, just to give you a taste of maybe what you're missing if you're not a patron. And that's on us. We'll publish that for free on Saturday. And also, speaking of Saturday, we've got the Q&A coming up. I'm excited. Live Q&A.
Me too. I love those.
This Saturday, hop onto YouTube. If you're a patron, you get to ask questions on the patron thread. That's already up, so go do that. Go ask questions. Go vote on the questions you like. But even if you're not a patron, you are absolutely invited to hop on YouTube. This will be Saturday, this coming Saturday, the 31st, at 11 Pacific, 2 Eastern. And that'll be a lot of fun. We, like I said, only patrons get to ask questions, so that's a perk. But, you know, we'll interact with the chat a little bit, and we'll have a good time. It's really fun. If you haven't been able to make it to a live Q&A video, it's a lot of fun. So go hop on the YouTube channel or keep an eye out on the social media links. We will push those out there for you. Okay, how are we doing on all those announcements? Did I cover it? I think I did.
I think that covers the administrative stuff.
So let's talk about one more thing that we don't get to talk about because, listeners, you might have heard, you might have seen a couple days ago, there was maybe a big, you know, breaking story that Trump's documents, like loan documents, were released or leaked. And wouldn't you know it, some Russians guaranteed his loan, you know, like co-signed a loan. And I saw that and I thought either... either this is not real or if it is real, I'm sure we'll hear more about it. And I asked Andrew about it. And sure enough, I think it's been retracted. Is that right?
Yeah, this was a Lawrence O'Donnell report that was based off of a single source, and there were no documents to corroborate. So a lot of folks asked us about it on Twitter, and as soon as it came out, right, the answer that we gave was, hey, look, like, we can't cover stories when, A, there aren't underlying documents, and B, we don't have multiple source confirmation, right? Because otherwise, we're just repeating what the news says. We're not, you know, helping you analyze the news. So that looks pretty like a pretty good decision now. I mean, I don't want to strain our arms patting ourselves on the back here. This morning, Lawrence O'Donnell has retracted that story. Lawyers for the president. Yes, issued a cease and desist and said, we're going to sue you for defamation. This is an illustration of how defamation law continues to operate, right? Like, I mean, we've talked about the New York Times v. Sullivan Standard. We've talked about Bat Boy. We've talked about, you know, knowing falsity or reckless disregard for the truth. Going forward with a lack of journalistic standards, when somebody says, hey, this isn't true, is one of the few ways in which you can actually run afoul of the New York Times v. Sullivan Standard, right? So, in other words, there is zero chance that the president could win a defamation lawsuit against Lawrence O'Donnell for that initial story. But failing to retract the story when you know or strongly suspect that it is either false or not up to journalistic standards is when you can. And so as a result, Lawrence O'Donnell and MSNBC have retracted the story. Look, that doesn't mean that Russians haven't co-signed some of Trump's loans, right? But the way this initial story came out was one of those that should have set off your BS detectors, right? It the story said that the Deutsche Bank documents confirmed that all of Trump's loans were co-signed by Russians. And I, you know, be careful and be skeptical.
This is just really frustrating. Like, stop making Glenn Greenwald have a point. People, like, that's why are we doing this to ourselves? It's one of those things. I don't watch cable news because I can't stand it. But like, so maybe that's why I tend to not be on the side of, oh, Democrats have gone nuts with all the conspiracy theories about Russia. But like, when I see this and I'm like, well, gosh, maybe someone has a point if they're thinking the left got a little too carried away with Russia. But at the same time, there was some there still is some there. And I just want to say that I, for one, am a big fan of what Andrew does in making sure that we can back up what we say and that we, you know, like, you're never going to bat 1,000, but like, doing our absolute best and then doing an Andrew was wrong segment and blaming it on him if anything is wrong is is the way we do it. And, you know, it is important to, you know, this isn't a both sides thing. There isn't any sort of equivalence between like what's happening on Fox News and what's happening on MSNBC. Don't for a minute think that I think that's in any way equal. But it still is important to, you know, practice some good journalism and not get carried away with a story that you can't back up. And I think it's frustrating that this happened. I'd love to be able to count on, when I see a headline like that from a source like that, to be able to count on that it's backed up, and it wasn't. So,
yeah. And I just want to, add one more thing to the false equivalence, right? Right. Lawrence O'Donnell was overly exuberant in going forward with a story that was very, very critical of the president, right? That's a bad thing. He did that on an opinion show, right? Not on a mixed opinion and news show. And the important thing here is it got retracted the next day, right? Like, he went on air on MSNBC and said, and, you know, here's the quote: I repeated statements that a single source told me about the president's finances. I gave it a he then, you know, says, I gave it the qualifier, if true, saying, if true, as I discussed, the information was not good enough. I did not go through the rigorous verification and standards process here at MSNBC before repeating what I heard from my source. Had it gone through that process, I would not have been permitted to report it. I should not have said it on the air or posted on Twitter. I was wrong to do so. Today, we are retracting the story. Tonight, we are retracting the story. We don't know whether the information is accurate, but the fact is, we do know it wasn't ready for broadcast, and for that, I apologize. Look, you'd rather the event not happen, but this further goes to show the disparity, right? Like,
yeah.
This is journalistic standards and ethics still in effect, right? This is somebody going, yeah, you know what? You called us out, and even though I would love to bring down the president, and again, it's an opinion show. There's no, you know, nothing wrong with everybody knows where Lawrence O'Donnell stands politically to say, yeah, we shouldn't have gone forward with that story. I cannot recall. I mean, you know, Democrats have even stopped asking Fox News to, you know, to retract libelous, unsourced.
Yeah, well, they had
statements.
To do a retraction for Seth Rich. Right. But then they like kept doing it. Like, they did a retraction, but then they're still. They're still talking about it. It's
yes,
weird.
And people died, right? Yeah. I mean, yeah. So there is. It continues. You know, if you have family members that you're talking to, that you know, they're not in the Trump camp, but they're in the like, well, I don't listen to MSNBC and I don't listen to Fox. I like, you know, that's a false equivalence, right? MSNBC. Their opinion shows have a strong liberal bias. MSNBC was not, during the Obama administration, a coordinated mouthpiece and propaganda arm of the administration, right? I mean, Rachel Maddow was as critical of Obama as, you know, any mainstream liberal.
Yeah, maybe
voice,
we need
right?
to revisit that, by the way. Like, maybe that's, maybe we're going about this all wrong. Apparently.
Yeah. All right. I want to get off my soapbox, but that's one of those things that does bother me when people suggest that MSNBC and Fox News are equivalent but opposite. They are not.
Totally agree. And I just it doesn't take away from the fact like so many people try to use things like this, mistakes like this, to say the whole Russia thing was a hoax and there's not even a case for impeaching the president. Oh, no, there's very much still a case for impeaching the president. It's not even
absolutely
not even close. So,
absolutely.
All right. Well, that said, let's get to our actual show. We are going to talk about which is we've got questions on apportionment. that was fun. We're going to keep going with that. And then this awful. This is one of those things that I hoped wasn't going to be real, but now it's sounding like it is. The citizenship for service members overseas. I don't even know what to say about that. I'll just let Andrew tackle it in the main segment. And then we've got a brief Andrew was wrong segment. There you go. Well, we're just like Lawrence O'Donnell.
That's right. I should not have gone forward with this story. You'll hear about that in the C segment.
Okay, well, all that said, let's finally get to our first segment, and we've got some really good listener questions.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
Andrew, Emily says, census data is given directly to states. It does seem that states cannot independently verify the information, but the lawyer I spoke with indicated that the president's role is functionally ceremonial, and since the states get the data direct from the Census Bureau, it would be extremely difficult for lies to be told about the numbers. And let me just in case we got any new listeners, people who didn't hear the episode, this is, the third time we're talking about this? The apportionment episode. Go back and listen, because it was very scary what Andrew had stumbled onto, what President Trump might be able to do on his way out, assuming we win in 2020, really messing with how apportionment is done and how the census is done. So this question is related to that. Listeners have been trying to poke holes in Andrew's theory, and we're all rooting for the listeners because we would like this not to be true. So this particular question is asking, it sounds like the census data just goes straight to the states, and that the president's role is ceremonial and that he won't be able to put his finger on the scale or whatever with regard to any of these numbers. How does that sit with you, Andrew?
Yeah. So I want to give a shout out to Emily, who wrote us and said, hey, I listened to your episode. And then I went to a local town hall with my state representative, and I spoke to that person, and I spoke to a lawyer on the staff. And look, like, that's awesome, right? Like, that's precisely the kind of activism that we're trying to engender to get the story out here. I want to address what happened, which is, and again, I'm not suggesting that there was malice on the part of the state legislature or the state legislator or the lawyer or anything like that, or miscommunication or whatever. I think that it's important to clarify the distinction here. So the answer that you got, Emily, was with respect to the census data itself, right? That is transmitted to the states, and we won the Department of Commerce case, right? So the census data itself, I feel like, with some caveats that we'll discuss in the second question, is relatively free from tampering. I am not suggesting that Donald Trump can change the numbers. Hmm. What I'm suggesting is that Trump can apply a filter to the numbers in his apportionment calculus. And so, in other words, you can have good data, and then if you take the data, right, I mean, take an obvious example, right? Suppose the census data comes back and says there are 30 million residents in the state of California. And then Donald Trump goes, half of those are illegals. So I'm going to transmit that for apportionment purposes, California only gets 15 million residents, right? I don't think that would likely survive constitutional scrutiny. But Bill Barr is not going to let Trump do something that stupid. Bill Barr is an evil genius. What Bill Barr is going to do is craft for Trump a statement that says, here's all the data that we have been collecting since 2019 by executive order from the various other departments that give us a rational basis to believe the percentage of undocumented immigrants living in California is X percent. Therefore, we're going to apply that X percent filter, and therefore California will be apportioned on a Y basis. Right. That's the concern. And with respect to that, I want to address the lawyer's statement, because that statement is something I can understand a lawyer saying off the cuff, right? That the president's role in transmitting the census data for apportionment purposes to the Congress is essentially, quote from your letter, functionally ceremonial, end quote. I get why you would think that. In the 20th and 21st centuries, the presidential role has been functionally ceremonial. But if you look at the underlying case, right, that is the Franklin versus Massachusetts decision that we've been talking about. It's 505 U.S. at page 800, quote, that the final act in apportionment is that of the president is important to the integrity of the process and bolsters our conclusion. This is the Supreme Court's conclusion that his duties are not merely ceremonial or ministerial. So in other words, what the lawyer said is incorrect. The governing law from the Supreme Court, binding precedent directly on point, says that what the president does is more than just take a piece of paper from the Department of Commerce to the Congress. And that's what I'm worried about. So plus one for getting out there and being active.
Yeah.
But I want to make sure that everybody listening understands the distinction between the generation of the numbers. We have fought and we have won thanks to Thomas Hofeller dying. And
oh, I thought you were going to say me. I mean, I did a
thanks
lot.
Thanks to Thomas Smith. Yeah. Thanks to Thomas Hofeller writing a document that says how to advantage Republicans and non-Hispanic whites.
Yeah.
Thanks to his estranged daughter from making that public. And thanks begrudgingly to the tiny particle of conscience in the back of John Roberts' brain that said, all right, I can't sign on to that. We have by the skin of our teeth, just barely managed to hang on to the integrity of the data, that does not mean that the president cannot apply his non-ceremonial, non-ministerial, whatever it is he does, as a filter to the data. So that's what I'm worried about.
Okay, so no go on that one. All right, we tried. Well, let's try again. I think this is still Emily asking. I think the real fallout from this administration is going to be an increase in the fear and suspicion. In 2010, my city hit 80% participation in the census. That was up from 2000, but still one-fifth of us were never counted.
Yep. I agree 100% with this second comment, right? That is part of the game, right? In addition to the apportionment, this administration is trying to depress compliance with the citizenship, with the census, by trying to promote the notion that there will be a citizenship question and that you will be deported. And, look, we're going to get to that in the B segment. That is the theme of the Trump administration. So I agree 100%. And that is the other half of, you know, I just finished saying to Emily's first question, we can trust the data. You can trust the data with an asterisk, right? Which is, we know historically that these communities go underreported, and there is a full court press to try and further underreport them. So 100% agree on that.
All right. Well, final question here. Last round in the Street Fighter. Can you take on this horrible idea that we wish Andrew hadn't thought of? So several people, including Brian Babcock, Daniel Lim, Mark Byfield, and some others have asked, what if, okay, here we go. Last attempt, everybody. Hail Mary time. What if the new Democratic Congress increased the number of congressional seats for 2022? That would necessitate a new presidential calculation, and more House districts will dilute the Electoral College advantage of the small population states. That's not really true for the presidency, right? But, anyway, Brian adds that it will make gerrymandering harder. So, yeah, great question there. Is that, have we found it? Do we win?
So we have found an answer. If Congress passes a law that amends the Apportionment Act of 1929, that's 2 USC 2A, that's the law we're talking about, they can absolutely pass that after the census. It doesn't mean we take a new count, but we've already said that the count is going to be, you know, subject to the caveat from the last segment, as accurate as we can get it. And that would require the transmission of a new statement, right, from President Elizabeth Warren, that would moot the Trump statement. So, yes, that will fix the problem. Let me address the other components of this, because I'm not sure that will be right. I am not confident that the incoming Congress will do this. But the biggest reason is, right, doubling or tripling the size of the Congress diminishes the power each individual member of the House of Representatives has. Mm. So they have a very, very strong interest, personal interest, in not doing that, right? When you're one of 435, that's better than being one of 1,300. Let me address the subcomponents. Will it dilute the Electoral College advantage of small population states? Yes, it will. Right now, small states have fewer have a lower population to congressional district threshold than larger states, right? Because no matter how small your state is, you still get one representative at minimum. So if we lower the threshold for what it takes to get a representative, then we can reduce that. It's basically a rounding error, right? So everything, the average congressional district is 700,000 seats, is 700,000 persons making up one seat. Some districts, some states are as much as 900,000. Some states are as few as 500,000. And those are states with, you know, like Idaho has like 500,000 people in it. So if you lower the ratio, then you reduce the number of rounding errors. So it does indeed affect the
Stupid civics 101 question. So this also changes the electoral college voting.
Correct.
Not just the House. Okay. So I forgot about that.
Because a state's electoral votes are its number of House seats plus number of senators, which is two. So that also dilutes the two senators per state, right? Which is right now, you know, in the current system, where you have 538 total electoral votes, the fact that no state can have fewer than three, right?
Yeah.
Also gives additional power. You triple the number of congressional seats, and now all of a sudden, no state will have fewer than three. They will have a smaller percentage of the total electoral vote pie because you're adding a constant plus a fraction. And I keep saying tripling. That's because at the time of the Apportionment Act of 1929, the average size of a congressional district was 200,000, right? So we've gone to more than triple, closing in on quadruple. And, you know, tripling sort of feels right in terms of what would keep pace.
Okay, this is my new plan. I don't know why it took so long for this to reach my brain. It's probably my fault. I heard someone talk about this, like the fact that we haven't done this for a very long time. We used to do it more regularly. And now I'm thinking this is maybe the best way to solve what I'm the most worried about going forward, which is this enormous discrepancy between the population and where we're centered versus who decides the presidency and who decides and who gets two Senate seats, which I guess that we can't fix, that we're stuck with. But I just think it's going to get worse and worse, where more and more and more people are located in these, you know, blue cities, who get then less and less of a say in our political system. And therefore, things will continue to regress in a Republican direction, despite the fact that most of the country increasingly might, you know, if this demographic trend continues and this population trend continues, want something completely different. And like, what would we ever do about that? Because a constitutional amendment would also require us to have presence in all of these different states, right? So this sounds like maybe a way to mitigate that. And yes, it sucks for the people in the House, you know, like House members won't want to dilute their power, but I think they should suck it up because A, you don't keep your House seat forever. Like there's a lot of turnover in the House. And B, if we can't ever have the Senate, you know, or if we're worried about ever having the Senate or ever having the presidency because of this electoral college disadvantage, the House becomes useless anyway. So we should really do this. Like, we should just increase the number by a lot so that we mitigate that electoral college disadvantage that we have. What do you think?
So that's my pitch. So now I'm on board with 90% of that. Let me throw a tiny bit of cold water on it, which responds to Brian's question, which is it will make gerrymandering harder. I whipped up a quick Excel spreadsheet, which I call the Gerrymandotron, which I will upload for patrons. You can play
probably
around with
gerrymandering
my spreadsheet.
Easier, doesn't it?
It as far as I can tell. It has no effect on gerrymandering. So what I did was I took a state, let's call it North Carolina.
Let's call this hypothetical state.
You call it North Carolina.
What a weird name. I've never heard of that. Okay.
I know. It's crazy. And you can plug in the number of residents. So I started with.
So you pulled up Red Map. You got
Is right. This is basically the lowest tech Red Map you can do, right? And I said, look, let's assume 10 million residents, split 50-50 between Democrats and Republicans. Start off with 10 districts, and it's super easy to create 8 safe 60-40 Republican districts and 2 totally packed inner city Democratic districts that are 90-10, right? That's the current strategy. I then expanded that out to 25 districts, and you can keep the exact same ratio, right? I can make it 20 safe Republican seats and 5 safe Democrats, overwhelmingly packed Democratic seats. So which is the same 80% you know, turning a 50-50 state into an 80-20 landslide, which is exactly what North Carolina has done. So the argument that it would make gerrymandering harder is one that is not viable in light of the Supreme Court's Rucho decision, right? Because I think what Brian is thinking is, well, you know, that just the geographic realities, it's harder to find people, right? But after Rucho, those are non-justiciable questions, right? So you can have a district that is like a street wide that, you know, goes through the wilderness for 300 miles to pick up part of the city in order to do that, right? So I was envisioning what this might look like, and I haven't come up with a clever name for it, but instead of the like gerrymander, right, it looks like a salamander, you know, because it kind of winds around, but it's not like you could have districts that look like a bowl of pasta, right? Like it literally like crazy tendrils everywhere. I have come full circle to it's time to crash the system and embarrass John Roberts. Like, let's start in New York and California. Let's create some pasta districts. but until we do that, right, until we seize control in a totally unfair way of the redistricting process in blue states with blue legislatures, I would be concerned in adding a whole bunch of legislators, given the structural advantage that Republicans have with gerrymandering right now. And again, it's not going to make it worse, right? But it may make it harder to make it better. So that's the only kind of bit of cold water. But the solution works to the 2USC 2A problem. Congratulations on our listeners, and I guess we need to start.
We cracked it. We took down M. Bison. He's down.
Yeah, got him. No Blanca balls on this one. So,
That's okay. That's interesting. My first like just intuition, like right away, trying to think of it was, well, if you have two districts, that's really hard to gerrymander. So therefore, maybe if you have a million, it's easier. But like when you lay that out, I guess that probably wasn't sound. Once you reach a certain amount. Or a certain number of districts, then it, I guess it kind of makes sense that it would even out in the way that it sounds like you're describing. But anyway, regardless of that,
your mathematical intuition is correct there, but that's where geographical reality comes out because, right, you can't gerrymander Idaho right now because they only have one congressional district, but Idaho doesn't have any cities in it anyway. So, right, there's nothing to gerrymander. So you are correct, though, that moving from very, very small numbers of congressional seats to larger seats increases that opportunity. Once you're already at the
at some sort of threshold,
reasonable state level, then the tripling. And this is I only did 2.5 because I just wanted the numbers to be to stay round. But once you do that, then then it becomes functionally equivalent.
But this is my new plan. The only thing I would add is if the House, you know, doesn't want to give up power, could they just add like one seat in order to like let's imagine Trump and Barr do their master plan of depriving, you know, some blue states of some number of seats through their tampering. Would Congress be able to do like, well, we're going to add like one seat and then be able to configure the whole thing?
So that's a really interesting question. The way they would have to do that is to, to have like a multiplicand of like 1.03 or you know what I mean? Something that the House of Representatives could not by fiat say, okay, we're going because the method is prescribed by the Reapportionment Act. So they have to use the same methodology, but they absolutely could say we're going to increase the size of the overall size of Congress to from 435 to, 438 or something like that. And
just to mess with Nate Silver.
Yeah.
Just to make Nate Silver have to like get
which I am a huge fan of, as longtime listeners of the show know. So.
Yeah, yeah. 540.com. Actually, we should business idea. Let's buy up all the
there you go. The, yeah. All right. Our listeners are out there right now buying 540.com, 541.com. Good for them.
Okay. Well, this is cool. I kind of crowdsourced it and cracked it maybe. So, but this is seriously my new plan. Let's redo all this and it'll solve, well, it'll help go towards solving a lot of problems. And to anybody who wants to whine about their house seat being less valuable, it's useless now. It's approximately useless currently. So, I mean, assuming the only problem is once we, you know, if we are able to take all three branches, then, you know, obviously the house then no longer is useless. So maybe that, you know, it'll be tough to get them to want to give that up. But just for the future, like it would be so much better for Democrats to do this, I think.
I agree.
Right. Well, why don't we take a little break, and then we are going to talk about this awful news about the citizenship stuff with service members. So, cool. Let's take a break. Opening Arguments is brought to you by Policy Genius. Did you know that September is National Life Insurance Awareness Month? I bet you didn't know that. That's probably, in fact, most people aren't aware they even need life insurance at all, and that's why 40% of Americans don't have it. But getting life insurance doesn't need to be difficult or expensive. Right now, prices are the lowest they've been in 20 years, and Policy Genius has made it easier than ever to get covered. Folks, this is something I did as part of, I don't know, being an adult, you know, of having a family, of realizing that, you know, anything could happen. And having the peace of mind that in the event that something bad happens, my family will be taken care of, that is very comforting to me. And it's not expensive and it's not hard. And Policy Genius will help you with that. It is the easy way to shop for life insurance online. In minutes, you can compare quotes from top insurers to find your best price. Once you apply, the Policy Genius team will handle the paperwork and the red tape. If you need life insurance, but you haven't gotten around to it, National Life Insurance Awareness Month is a good time to get started. Go to policygenius.com. Get quotes and apply in minutes. You can do the whole thing on your phone right now. Policy Genius, the easy way to compare and buy life insurance. Okay, Andrew, I don't even know what to make of this. Like, I don't even know what putting on my Trump hat, which is a Klan hood. So putting on my Klan hood, I don't even know what the logic behind this is. Like, is there really a constituency for wanting to take away citizenship from people who are serving, but like are born. All right. Why don't you explain this? I'm really having a hard time.
Yeah. And this is really, really legally complicated. And almost everybody is, they are accurately reporting what the rulemaking does, but not understanding the implications. So I'm going to break it down for you. It's terrifying and it's way worse than it seems, right? And it seems really, really super bad. It's way worse than that. So this is a memorandum dated yesterday, August 28th, 2019, from the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. And it is meant as clarifying the internal agency's interpretation of various rules and statutes with respect to citizenship. In order to understand why it does what it does, we need to break down the different ways in which you can be a citizen of the United States, right? So, in the second half of this segment, we're going to talk briefly, because this document does not really discuss birthright citizenship. But obviously, under the 14th Amendment, if you are born in this country, you are a citizen. Notwithstanding the fact that Donald Trump has said, I'm going to end birthright citizenship, notwithstanding the fact that some very right-wing hacks have been calling for that, that is part of the game plan and the energy in the racist Trump base. And I should add, if we're trying to, and God, it's hard to steel man Donald Trump, very few countries have birthright citizenship, right? Yeah. So there is a non-racist argument to be made. I don't know that that's being made, you know, by the folks who were in favor of ending it. But doesn't matter. It would require a constitutional amendment to end birthright citizenship in the United States, notwithstanding what Donald Trump and Trump supporting racists have said. But put a pin in birthright citizenship, because the other way in which you can be a U.S. citizen is you can be born outside the United States, but nevertheless qualify for citizenship. And that's where this comes in, because there's essentially a two-tracked process. Okay, and all of this comes from the fact that this language is inferred from the 14th Amendment, right? So there is a tremendous amount of sort of legislative freedom to decide what counts as being born in the United States or not. So the first place we start is 8 U.S.C. 1401. That is the Immigration and Naturalization Act. And subsection A says you're born in the United States. Again, we're going to get to that. Subsections C through E, there are others, but C through E govern people who are born outside the United States, right? And they say, so subsection C, for example, says if you're born outside the United States and you have parents, both of whom are citizens, and one of whom has a residence in the United States, then you're automatically a citizen. Okay. Subsection D says if you're born outside the United States and one of your parents is a citizen and that person has been, quote, physically present in the United States or one of its outlying possessions for a continuous period of 1 year prior to the birth of such person and the other of whom is a national but not a citizen of the United States, then you're automatically a citizen. And subsection E says if one of your parents is a citizen, been physically present in the U.S. for a year at any time prior to the birth, then you automatically become a citizen. If you fall into any other category, right? So let's say you have one parent is a citizen, but they've only been physically present in the United States for 11 months prior to the birth of the child. Then instead of that person automatically becoming a citizen, they get funneled into section 1433, which basically says you can apply to have that child naturalized. Okay? So in other words, the difference in this criteria is the difference between automatic and application. Make sense so far?
I think so.
Yep. So the automatic standards has only three requirements. This document tries to change that. This is section 1431. So it says a child born outside the United States automatically becomes a citizen when all of the following conditions have been fulfilled. One, at least one parent is a citizen. Two, the child is under the age of 18 years. And three, the child is residing in the United States in the legal and physical custody of the citizen parent pursuant to a lawful admission for permanent residence. Okay. This document adds, and you can see it, and this is the reason why this document will be challenged in court and enjoined from going into effect, because you can look directly on page 4, and it says, of this document, a child born outside the United States automatically becomes a U.S. citizen when all the following conditions have been met. And it lists those three things. And then it adds as a bullet, the child is a lawful permanent resident. Huh. That's not true. That is not in the law. And they can't just add that criterion by fiat. The Department of Citizenship is not the legislature. That exceeds the delegation of congressional authority under the INA. That part, at minimum, will be enjoined in this act. Nobody is talking about the fact that this tries to add that bullet, and that bullet will not stand.
Okay. Problem solved, huh?
No, because the top line of what this document does is say that the USCIS no longer considers children of U.S. government employees and U.S. Armed Forces members residing outside the United States as residing in the United States for purposes of acquiring the automatic citizenship that I just talked about. So what that means is all of those children, right, are now funneled from 1431 automatic process into 1433, which is the process where you have to apply for naturalization. So you no longer get it automatically. You now have to apply. There are three bad things about that. One, you have to apply. So that's work. It's costly. You have to hire an immigration lawyer, right? That's bad. Number two, there is discretion. The attorney general issues a certificate of citizenship to the applicant upon proof of meeting the qualifications in the statute. So there's a Bill Barr gets to decide whether you count or not. And third, and this is the real game, 1433 adds as a requirement, it's subsection B5 that says, the child is temporarily present in the United States pursuant to a lawful admission and is maintaining such lawful status. So in other words, you now get to argue that the child is not here legally in order to deny immigration status. That's what they want to do in shifting thousands of people, which again, this is a major, major percentage of children born outside the United States every year who are nevertheless eligible for U.S. citizenship, right? I mean, that they're members of the armed forces and U.S. government employees living abroad. That's right. I mean, you know, there's a small number of people on vacation, but like this is the biggest category of people who fall into that this particular section of the code.
It makes sense. People probably don't often take a vacation when they're like 9 months pregnant.
Yeah, right. So in this, what this will do is this shifts them from an automatic citizenship into a discretionary citizenship. And the attorney general can deny that discretionary naturalization under the subsection 5 by saying that that child has not maintained lawful status in the United States. That's why they're doing that. And believe me, they will use that. I mean, we know how the, I don't need to say it. We know how this administration will use that discretion.
Well, but like, I still don't understand why this seems so unnecessary on so many levels. Even for Trump, I don't get it. It's people in the armed forces, and
look, I can't come up with a better explanation than fascist leadership principle to appease your rabid base that cares about demonizing immigrants. And I realize that sounds super extreme.
It's not even immigrants, though.
Demonizing brown people.
Okay, I'm sorry if I'm just really dumb. This doesn't even seem like it would necessarily be anyone of a certain race. Isn't it just if you are a service member, like you're a service member, right? So where's the racial component come into?
The service members, particularly, and we have a lot of members of the armed forces who listen, way more racially diverse than the population at all. So our on the ground, you know, members of the Army, Navy, those folks are overrepresented in minority groups. And we're talking about people stationed abroad. So they're stationed overseas and they meet non-U.S. citizens. That's how you wind up with one parent being a U.S. citizen by virtue of, being a U.S. citizen and serving in the military, being overseas and meeting a foreigner and having a child with that foreigner. This is racial purity. I mean, again, yeah. I'd love for there to be
I
some.
Can't think
I'd
of
love
any way
for there to be some
not,
other explanation. Yeah. I can't.
That's. I guess that's why I'm confused, because it's there's no other possible justification, and this seems like a lot of work for not that much return. Like I mean. How do you have any figures as to how many people this could possibly be?
It's several thousand potentially.
Yeah, but so, like,
so, I, yeah, agree. So, I agree. Yeah. It is symbolic. Do you want to know the worst part that I haven't talked about?
Oh, we haven't
yet?
Gotten to the worst part, huh? Jeez.
Yeah, there's a worst part. Right. And this is a part that no one is talking about, except us. We talked about this a year and a half ago, episode 143. On top of all of the criteria that we just described is section 1409. This applies to the automatic provision. So this is another sorting provision, right? And it says the provisions of C, D, E, and G, right? Those are the ones that I read to you, shall apply as of the date of birth to a person born out of wedlock if, and then there's a whole bunch of stuff, right? And again, that's because the law was passed in the 1920s and amended in the 1950s, and we cared about, you know, children being born out of wedlock and, you know, nonsense, right? That provision out of wedlock has been used and will continue to be used as an overt club deliberately discriminatorily against LGBT couples.
Right.
And just as a reminder, right, you remember when we covered this, we covered Alison Blick's lawsuit. By the way, I checked in. That lawsuit survived a motion to dismiss. So it's in the discovery stage. I think ultimately she's likely to win that lawsuit. We are overdue. So there will be a small victory when she does. It will be Pyrrhic because the U.S. government is trying to deny a U.S. citizen that her child is a U.S. citizen, and it is no one should have to litigate that. She's going to win. The Trump administration has taken the position that if you use assisted reproductive technology, that's their word. That is what that's what they call the combined categories of artificial insemination, surrogacy, in vitro fertilization. Right? I mean, all of those things. Right. If you have a lesbian couple, obviously you need to use assisted reproductive technology. If you have a particularly if you have a gay couple, right, gay male couple, you probably have to use assisted reproductive technology unless one of the partners is a trans male. But in the overwhelming percentage of those relationships, and therefore the overwhelming percentage of parents who use assisted reproductive technology skews heavily in the LGBT community. And this, page 6-7, is what this document says about the out-of-wedlock criterion. It says, out-of-wedlock and assistive reproductive technology means that the child's gestational mother is the person who triggers all of these provisions of section 1409. Let me break down what that means. That means if a lesbian couple has a child artificially, it's their child artificially inseminated, it depends on in whose womb that child is implanted for whether that child will automatically become a citizen under 1401. And let me give you a very, very real world example. This was a lesbian couple that had twins, had one twin implanted in one parent and one twin implanted in the other. Geez. I think that's pretty beautiful. The U.S. government took the position that because it's the gestational mother, one was a citizen and one was not. That's what we covered in 143. That is reinforced in this document from USCIS. And that is the second half of this. So it is not only demonizing brown people, it is also demonizing LGBTQ individuals.
Look, yeah.
I mean, put it out there. Look, let's make our call. We have people who say, you know, I'm conservative and I, right? Not a lot, but we do. If you can give me a justification for this that is not evil, yeah, racism and bigotry, I'll air it, right?
But, no, it absolutely is. And as much as we all already knew that this administration was capable of very great evils and pointless bigotry, I still find myself taken aback at the amount of work they're willing to do for something that is so minuscule in the grand scheme of things. Like it's actually breathtaking. Like it's, there's a new level of evil to that, you know, like you can't even, I don't even know what to say. Like a couple thousand kids, you know, like, is that going to make a difference in your, you know, white nationalist policy that there are a couple out of 250 million, 300 million people. Like you're going to go to this length.
That's because it's a statement to your base, right? You are absolutely correct that if you look at it from a utilitarian policy making perspective,
I don't even it makes know no that sense. That's true. I don't even know that it works as a statement to your base. Like it's too hard to understand. Like you, I don't even think people, you yourself are saying that like, we're not even getting the reporting on half of this. I think I have to say my guess, and I could be wrong. I feel like it's more about the individual evils of the people in charge than it is about making a statement to the base.
That's not a head space in which I live.
It's not speculation either way.
Yeah. I have no basis to say, but yeah, so it is, yes, this is targeting the U.S. military, which seems like a weird thing for a Republican to do, right? Yeah. The Republicans are supposed to be the rah-rah
really
military.
Care about the troops. They
absolutely are not supporting the troops here. Because it's such a small number, it's unlikely to make a real difference, right? It's unlikely to have an actual backlash against service members who overwhelmingly vote Republican. Guys, it's time to stop doing that. Gals, it's time to stop doing that. But yeah, so, and hidden within, not hidden, hidden in plain sight, but because of the overt evil, the more difficult to decipher evil involving the selective use of the out of wedlock provisions is something that this administration has doubled down on. And I don't want us to lose that.
Wow. Well, that's horrifying on every level. Is there more? I was going to tap out and get to the Andrew Wrong segment.
Tap out, but let me before we hit the Andrew Wrong segment.
We got to know everything.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the birthright citizenship provision because this is safe.
You'd need an amendment, right?
Yeah, and I got a question. I got two separate questions regarding birthright citizenship. So let me see if I can't lightning round. Birthright citizenship protected by the 14th Amendment, codified by Section A of 1401 that says a person, the following shall be citizens of the United States at birth. A person born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. And if you're thinking, does subject to the jurisdiction thereof mean, you know, not counting illegal aliens? No, right? Like if you're an illegal alien and again, that term is a meaningless term. If you are if you are a person of undocumented status, if you are here illegally and you commit a crime in the state of Texas, you are subject to the jurisdiction of the state of Texas and the U.S. government. Right. So that does not mean having lawful status. And you can tell that because other sections of the INA have the phrase, right? Lawful status, right? So we know that's not what that means. Indeed, what it means is set out in a bunch of 19th century cases, including the one that a whole bunch of racists think means it doesn't mean what it says it means. And that case is called United States versus Wong Kim Ark. It's an 1898 Supreme Court case. And it is interpreting birthright citizenship in the 14th Amendment. And here's what the Supreme Court says. Right? It says, all children who are born here are citizens, including children of resident aliens, with the exceptions or qualifications as old as the rule itself of, and here's the list, children of foreign sovereigns or their ministers, Okay, well, that makes sense, right? Like if you have Italians at the Italian embassy, that's considered Italian soil. Child is born at the Italian embassy, or they're born at the hospital, right? Like then that child is not an American citizen, right? That child is an Italian citizen. Okay, makes total sense. Or born on foreign public ships. All right, that also makes sense, right? Like you have these people vacationing on a luxury liner while 9 months pregnant. They give birth in Boston Harbor, but you know they're Paraguayan, right? Like the child is not an American citizen, even though they were born in Boston, right? Or of enemies within and during a hostile occupation of part of our territory.
Ooh, that's the Americans, that TV show. I guess their kids shouldn't be citizens.
Right, right. And this is the end. And with the single additional exception of children of members of the Indian tribes owing direct allegiance to their several tribes. And that's where you can probably anticipate the argument that racists have made and that the Supreme Court entertained in this Wong Kim Ark case. Obviously, that was made because that was not quite, you couldn't put Native Americans in the category of, you know, a hostile occupation of part of our territory. This was their territory. So, you know, they created another class again, because our race relations aren't great today, but they really sucked in 1898. And so the Supreme Court said, you know, OK, so, right. Foreign soldiers on our soil as an occupying hostile foreign power. Obviously, those kids aren't citizens. And also, if you have sort of openly declared your allegiance to a tribe that is hostile to the United States government, then the children of those Indians don't count, right? And then in the same case, there is dicta, because this case was about Chinese immigrants who were born in the United States, the Wong Kim Ark case. And it says, right, Chinese persons remaining subjects of the Emperor of China and not having become citizens of the United States are entitled to the protection of and owe allegiance to the United States so long as they're permitted by the United States to reside here and are subject to the jurisdiction thereof in the same sense as all other aliens residing in the United States. Right. So this involved two Chinese nationals living in the United States, had a child. And then the Supreme Court's like, yeah, obviously that child is a U.S. citizen. And so racists have attempted to argue that the Wong Kim Ark decision means that there is this implicit criterion of, do you owe allegiance to the United States or to some other country, to then argue by analogy and extension that if you are outside of documented status in the United States, you don't owe allegiance to the United States. You owe allegiance to the country you came from, and therefore under that you don't count and citizenship doesn't extend to you. I want, you know, to, since this has been a pretty depressing segment, I want to tell you that argument is nonsense, is weapons grade nonsense, so bad that even the Trump administration is not making it. It's not so bad that it hasn't gotten featured in the pages of the National Review. So the next time somebody tells you that that's a respectable, I'll link that in the show notes. 2015 article, by the way. It's a Go Trump article when he was, you know, like the next time somebody tells you that is a respectable intellectual magazine, you know, link them to this one. They're too racist for Donald Trump. But that argument, no case has ever stood for that proposition. No case has followed that dicta from Wong Kim Ark. It has not been cited since 1898. And even this Supreme Court is not going to take the racist attitudes of 1898.
Famous last words.
Yeah,
Torres.
Well,
Amy Coney Barrett gets in there.
I think this would be a 9-0. Amy Coney Barrett, this would be an 8-1. But I think Neil Gorsuch, maybe it's all right. I don't know what Clarence Thomas is going to do. I can never predict that guy. But this is an 8-1 at minimum. There is no way to take birthright citizenship away from people who are here outside of documented status.
And I feel so much better. So we're not going back to the 1890s, just the 1920s or something.
Well, no, to the 1890s. We're not going back to the 1830s. Oh, pages yeah. okay. 3 and 4 of this reflect birthright citizenship. And somebody asked, is this an effort to rescind birthright citizenship? It is not. I want to read it carefully. It says, a U.S. citizen may have automatically acquired U.S. citizenship based on birth in the United States. And then there's a footnote. But never actually resided in the United States. This U.S. citizen will not have established residence in the United States and may be unable to transmit U.S. citizenship to his or her own children. That, as far as I can tell, that is an accurate statement of the law, right? In terms of what that's saying is, if you have birthright citizenship because you were born in the United States, but then you leave the country and you reside your entire life outside of the United States, then your children do not qualify or may not qualify for the automatic provisions of 1431, will be forced under the discretionary provisions of 1433. I think that's a correct reading of the law. And so I want, this does not attempt to modify birthright citizenship, even though I can understand why, when, you know, you're reading this from bad actors, why it would look that way. So there you go. The Trump administration is sacrificing active service members and couples having in vitro fertilization. I would sure love it if those folks went from being, you know, in the military, you know, from being on average Trump supporters and, you know, upper class white people who a distressing number of them voted for Donald Trump in 2016. Those are people being targeted right now. If you're a rich white couple and you travel abroad a lot and you're child is currently being hosted by a surrogate mother. Again, this is rich white behavior. That's the Republican base. You know, you may be sacrificed to, you know, for whatever purpose this is supposed to do. So, you know.
All right, I'm tapping out. We got to get to the next.
It's good time to tap out.
I feel so much better after that brief good news about 1898.
Ms. Vito, please answer the question. Does the defense's case hold water?
No.
Andrew
is wrong.
Are you sure?
I'm positive. All right,
let's quickly do this. Andrew was wrong. What were you wrong about, sir?
I said Sonia Sotomayor was Solicitor General of the United States, and that was an idiotic thing to say. Elena Kagan was Solicitor General of the United States.
Duh, dummy. Yep. Everyone knows that.
So she was the Supreme Court justice who had the most recusals from 2007 to 2018. So mea culpa.
Well, that was fast. Okay, so nice correction. Now it is time. The only thing that can cheer us up is thanking our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats over at patreon.com/law. And we begin with, now let's just jump straight to T3BE this week. Nice. Good try. And they're the first patron, too, on the list. That's good. Emily Rainbow Spence, Elbow of Justice from the Sky. Any second now. Benoit B. Mandelbrot's middle name is Benoit B. Mandelbrot. Okay. You are now breathing consciously. Uh-oh. Let's move on so we don't start that. Michael Blevins, I'm donating as much to you as my wife does to church. Lost in the OA backlog. Please tell me it gets better. No. Attorney General O.J. Simpson's Department of Justice. I wanted to say justish, like justiciable. Justice. Hotspear.com. Keep your valuables and yourself safe at the beach. Internmentcamps.us. I don't know if that's good or bad. It's legal. It's advice. It's not legal advice. Ask your podcast if legal advice is right for you. My students in Japan. Oh, we lost the three-way there. There's just two. My students in Japan ask about Trump after missile alert drills. Sad. Jim Emke. Dragonfly.eco. Books about nature and the environment. Reviews and interviews. Ad Astra. Per Aspera. Nate Drex. Repeal the Second Amendment. Stuff and polls. We're not lawyers, but you can take our advice. SummitShuffleboard.com. Resolve, the United States should adopt a policy to decrease white supremacy. Well-deserved patron, number 239. Darth Mandy Pants. Ban Umbrellas, Fight the Menace of Lightning. Aminum Brewing. Valerie Galloway, 13th Century Saxony Gravel Truck Lawyer. Have a great weekend, everybody. Jennifer Cratch. Barbara LaWall is omnipotent and cannot act ultra-virus. The cure for ultra-virus. Trump walks into a bar and says, you won't recuse yourself, right? Pitter-patter, back to Chorin, more hands make less work. Have a safe Labor Day weekend. Stephen Baltikatai Sandoval, announcing OA's next live show in Seattle. I'm here for the overrated San Jose Sharks. I mean, we made it to the conference finals. I mean, how overrated can you be when you're in the top, you know, three or four teams? Read Factfulness at Bill Barr's Barbarian Beard Barber and Beer Bar. Adam Costa, Our Lady of Perpetual Motion. Alexa, play Move My Noodle by Thomas and the Opening Arguments.
Nice.
Oh, that's a good one. Andrea, the Arbitrary and Capricious. Jay Aldenwalt, another patron in favor of a live show in Seattle. All right, well, we'll do it for two of you. CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. Lorem Ipsum Loquitur, John Bilderback, the Registry Matters Podcast, The End is Nigh, The Amazon Fire is Because You Didn't Go to clownhornvoting.com, Yes Honey Buns, Eric Alsman, Thomas Smith is my favorite attorney, Andrew's a close second, Payne Strumpet, Colorado, where weed and shrooms are legal, but being homeless is a crime, Michael C. Sampson, and Trump and the Bible is a podcast I would listen to. Your turn, Andrew.
All right. Thanks to Kiwa Valley Exports for Australian red meat and craft beer, and now I am hungry and thirsty. Redaction Blackout should now be called Bill Bars. Let me be totally clear. I like being totally clear. Milo Meadsong, the halfling bard and assistant. I think this is Illinois. Assistant Illinois appellate defender. Sam Buck, karaoke something, Cosmo Blues, moving the noodle. Join your labor union, together we bargain, alone we beg. The time traveler who prevented Mitch McConnell's turtle invasion. Well, I don't know that we're better off, but yeah. Thanks. Guys, just go bald and stop worrying about it. No one cares. Well, thank you. That's sweet. Peace, love, and comfortable underwear. Half-price judicial eyebrow waxing. Enter Clown Horn at checkout. James Call, lounging around, drinking beer in my amicus briefs. Charleston, South Carolina live show next, please. Well, we'll certainly consider it. Jonathan Steele is a great dad fund. Anonymous. Buttercup's Legal Services, suing fascists since 2018, 831, Cat Law 1. Did the show outro change to cover the transcript edition? Yes, it did. Not sure pie is real. All the arguments for it strike me as circular. Trump right. was sent by God because he ran out of boils and locusts. Well, plausible. WordOrigins.org, your guide for legal terms from 13th century Saxony. How many licks to the center of a Tootsie Pop? A one, a two, redacted. David in Brooklyn, donate to Raices and the ACLU today. The Nancy Pelosi School of Leadership Failures. I'm not even sure that's a crime anymore. Fantastic Fletch quote. Live show Judicial Bikini Wax featuring Bush v. Gore. See, Bush v. Gore. That's pretty clever. I like that. Derek, my Patreon name is now in two tweets. Take that, Andrew. With stamps.com, you don't have to be ready for the package store. Concurrence, read Factfulness to develop a more reality-based worldview. A string of unpronounceable characters. No, classic there. Roald Dahl was a real-life James Bond super spy. Seriously, guys, he was. Really? The foremost Roald Dahl expert that I know is Eli Bosnick, so I'll have to ask him. Rhonda wants to recall Governor Dunleavy and save Alaska. Malika Chandler, good morning, Camp Quest. Abacus Flinch, Soggy Pants, Sam Danow, Greg Sullivan, Tiny Dick Damages, Matthew Vernon, Adopt a Homeless Pet and Oppose Declawing and Ear Docking, Aaron Grady, Heather L. Gosh, we love Heather L., our amazing transcriptionist. She's the best.
Oh, yeah.
StephenMiller.com is much better than that other non-human. Buy a rug. All right. Mike Oxhard. I'm not going to read that as though it's
Michael Oxhard. Yeah.
Michael Oxhard. His cousin, Michael Hunt, is also a patron. Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium. Ian and Allie, can't wait for the live OA show. I hope you're not still waiting outside the pit.
Yeah. What time warp are you stuck in?
Yeah. You're, you know, Eli Bosnick, Zabby, Teresa Gomez. Really, no Teresa Gomez special thing this week? I'm a little bit disappointed in you, Teresa. Mitchell, are we just ignoring how Thomas says thesaurus? No, in fact, we've talked about that at great length. Winterville Train Depot.
That's how I say it. Did you do that intentionally or did I infect you?
No. I did that intentionally. Okay. I say thesaurus like all God-fearing
like all
Americans.
Humans. Gotcha. Yeah.
Winterville Train Depot voting machine number 3. Gee, Zachary Terwilliger. And of course, the all-time great, our best, he who shall never be dethroned, but keep trying, Conrad Michaels.
All right, and now it's time for T3BE, which stands for Thomas Can't Answer a Question Right, I think. That's some sort of abbreviation for that. Here we go.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
Talk to the hand. I need your clothes. That's one of my mission parameters. Trust me. I know now why you cry.
All right. This is, and I am not making this, you just had banana law. This is don't take legal advice from a podcast law.
Whoa.
I'm 100% serious. So, Thomas, a law student, rented a furnished apartment. His landlord began to solicit his advice about her legal affairs, but he refused to provide it. Good on him. The landlord then demanded that he vacate the apartment immediately. The landlord also began engaging in a pattern of harassment, calling the student at home every evening and entering his apartment without his consent during times when he was at school. During these unauthorized visits, she removed the handles from the bathroom and kitchen faucets, making the faucets unusable.
The world?
But she did not touch any personal property belonging to the student.
She the wet bandit?
The lease has a year to run, and the student is still living in the apartment because, you know, assuming that this is Harvard Law School, I can get why, because it's really, really hard to find an apartment in Boston. The student has sued the landlord for trespass. Is he likely to prevail?
Great.
So, A, no, because he has no standing to sue for trespass. B, no, because the landlord caused no damage to his property. C, yes, for compensatory damages only, or D, yes, for injunctive relief, compensatory damages, and punitive damages.
Oh, man, I don't know. Gosh, when am I going to get one that I can get? It's tough. I don't know what, I mean, all right, let's use my instincts here. I don't know what the point of the legal advice stuff is. Soliciting advice, but he doesn't give it. I guess that's just what started this whole harassment campaign. Landlord then demanded he vacate immediately. That's interesting. So tries to just evict him, which that doesn't sound cool. The landlord also began engaging in a pattern of harassment, calling the student at home every evening, entering his apartment without his consent during times when he was at school. So I'm pretty sure, this could be one of those things where I'm spoiled by like California law or something, but I'm pretty sure that's not cool. Like even if you're the landlord, like you can't just enter a tenant's place, which I would logically and rationally would hope is the case that you can't do that. During the unauthorized visits, removed handles from the bathroom. So is this the kind of thing where like trespass is specifically, does that involve damaging anything or not? You know, is trespass going to be like the letter of the law means you have to damage his property too or something and not just the sink handles, which are technically not the student's property? It makes the question makes clear that the landlord didn't do anything to the personal property belonging to the student. All right. Likely to prevail. No, because he has no standing to sue for trespass. No, because the landlord caused no damage to his property. So if I was going for a no answer, it would probably be B. I can't imagine that no standing. So does trespass mean you have to own the property? Like maybe that's what it's going for. So if you don't own the apartment, it would it be some other kind of tort if the landlord came into your place unauthorized? I don't know. I'm not sure if that's true. Because what if it's not even the landlord? Like if you're renting an apartment and like a criminal just like breaks in, would that be trespass or would that be something else? You know, some other tort would cover that. But it seems like you should be covered by something for, you know, having a, you know, having a place you live be invaded in that way. So now I don't know if I would eliminate A necessarily. Yeah, I would lean toward B, if I was picking a no answer. No, because the landlord caused no damage to the property. Kind of that technicality of not having damaged anything. C, yes, for compensatory damages only. Seems weird. D, yes, for injunctive relief, compensatory damages, and punitive damages. I don't know, Andrew. It's almost like I'm not a lawyer. I don't know that I could see, I really could see an argument for almost every answer. It might be that there's some other tort that covers this, so therefore A is correct, and you don't have standing to sue for trespass if it's not your property. But I feel like this question would be a lot of work then for nothing, but maybe that's what the bar wants to do. But I'm gonna go away from A, so I'll eliminate A. B, you know, because the landlord caused no damage to his property, trespass. Gosh, I know we had a question that touched on that, like whether or not you actually damage something versus just being on the property. And there was some distinction there, and I can't remember what it was. C, yes, for compensatory damages. So like what would, that's what's weird. C seems weird to me because if anything, there aren't really compensatory damages because none of the student's personal property was touched. So I don't get. D, yes, for injunctive relief. I could see the injunctive relief, like stop doing this, and the punitive damages of like you're harassing the person, so stop doing, you know, damages for that. And then maybe compensatory if there's any. You know, all right, I've been getting these wrong so much. I'm going to zig instead of zag. I'm going to say, this is rough. I'm going to say A, no standing to sue for trespass. It's going against my instincts, but my instincts have been killing me every time. So I'm trying to zag or zig or whatever. I'm predictable. This bar exam has been predicting my behavior. I'm going to go with A and think that maybe there's some other tort that would cover this. That's not trespass because it is the landlord's property. So therefore you wouldn't have standing to sue for trespass. I don't know. I think it's wrong, but I'm going for it because I'm tired of getting these wrong. A is my final answer.
All right, and if you'd like to play along with Thomas, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag T3BE. Include your guess, your reasons, therefore, and we will pick a winner and shower that person with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
All right, thanks so much for listening to our depressing show about how evil the Trump administration is, because that's honestly, it is reality. So we're forced to be in this reality. But, you know, we can always vote. We can always organize and try to do something about it. Keep energized. Because we're up against it. All right. Thanks for listening. We will see you on Saturday for that Q&A. Come join us. See you then.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is a copyrighted production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved. Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our transcriptionist, Heather Leverage, production assistant, Ashley Smith, and with the generous assistance of our volunteer unofficial researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our merch and our live shows and also heads up the OA Wiki project. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian, and Teresa. Check out the Opening Arguments community on Facebook. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the fabulous OA theme song, which is used with permission.